We're in the Seattle Kitchen. Thank you for joining us. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Roach, your other chef in a hat.
And I'm Katie O.
We're going to be with you for the next 2 hours. Hopefully you're with us. That's the only way this thing works. I'm chef owner of some fine restaurants here in the downtown core, including where I had breakfast this morning at the Seatown Market Diner. I had a nice little scramble with mushrooms and sweet peppers and little jack cheese in there. It's a little custardy creamy. I love scrambled eggs with a lot of cheese in them.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah,
huh?
And we have the butter, the brown butter hash browns down there.
I think about those hash browns a lot.
Do you think about them?
I do. I love hash browns. So mm-hmm. I think about those. And
they're a little different, aren't they?
Yeah, the little crumbly brown butter mm-hmm. On top. It's so delicious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm Thierry Rotureau, the chef in a hat, owner of Luc in Madison Valley and Lule downtown Seattle, as well as a brand new line of fragrances.
There you go. And you know, Terry and I think we're meeting up tonight, right, at the EMP.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm sorry, sir. It's called the MOPOP.
MOPOP now. Yeah, it's not an experience music project anymore.
For the Founders Diner mm-hmm. Gala, the auction.
John Fogerty is the celebrant
that
tonight.
That is correct.
And we are apparently celebrating him.
Does anybody know who he is? Okay, you all know who he is, right? Okay, good.
They're not dead.
I'm just making sure, but some of them are very young.
Everyone knows who John Fogerty is.
Yes, well, you would think, but...
Can you sing one of his songs?
Yeah.
Please, regale us.
Oh, baby. How does that go?
I haven't a clue. I don't know. I don't even really know the guy.
Oh, you know a lot of his songs.
Yeah.
They're very American song, absolutely.
You know, I try to live in this century.
Oh, yes. Somebody who just talks about death after 60.
We have a very large show today.
Yeah,
despite what just happened, we usually talk just food and wine and fun restaurants around town. Chef Brittany Bartleben from the Dahlia Bakery is back to share her thoughts on a Yule log. I tasted it yesterday. Happens to be gluten-free, which is I don't think was on purpose. It just was the nature of the
recipe. That's how it was.
It was delicious. Gluten-free, delicious. Who knew?
You know, Tom, that cake that I brought is gluten-free, too.
Well, I didn't try the cake. It wasn't offered to me.
It sounds like everyone's trying to give you a hint.
Yeah. We're hosting a dinner party using the same ingredient in every course. How in the world are we going to do that? You'll have to listen to find out.
Yeah.
I'm going to share your favorite taste of the week. And, of course, it is my intention, since I worked out this morning, to kick some patootie.
And,
in the Two Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge.
And it's my intention to redeem myself since I lost last week.
Okay.
Sounds like a very big battle ahead. But before we do all of that good stuff, we're going to do some ordinary to extraordinary. This is where you take ordinary dishes and you make them extraordinary. And as you know, we are in the midst of Hanukkah.
Yay.
So, one of my favorite things for sure is the latke.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make the perfect potato pancake?
Well, I would say, just following the conversation...
Can we just clarify, neither one of us are Jewish?
Correct.
Okay, so whatever we do, we're simply trying.
We certainly like to adopt a lot of other cuisines, though, that
you
aren't
know what?
Ours.
When it's time to eat, religion goes out of the way.
Yeah. My favorite latkes
My belly doesn't have a religion.
My favorite latkes are crab latkes, so you can tell I'm not Jewish.
Yeah, you're kind of killing the whole idea.
Though Shelley Lance, your longtime cookbook co-author, mm-hmm. is Jewish, and mm-hmm. she makes the most delicious,
That's what
beautiful
made,
latkes, for sure.
It made the crab cake book, Grandma Pearl's latkes mm-hmm. with crab.
Yeah, delish. All right, Terry, you had an idea for
I would do a classic cured salmon, not smoked, cured. So you just do an overnight curing on a fillet of salmon, on a piece of salmon
mm-hmm.
with sugar, salt, herb, spices, fresh herbs, lots of fresh herbs, and you weigh the salmon down. And the next day, after 24 hours, basically that piece of salmon is cured, which means then basically all the water's come out. You rinse it off on the cold water. You pat it dry, and then you slice it super, super thin. And you make a creme fraiche. Or I know most people are going to use sour cream because they don't have creme fraiche, but you should buy creme fraiche because it's really delicious. It's got a sourness that sour cream doesn't have. And chopped shallots, capers, and a little bit of dill. Mix that the whole thing together and put that on top of the smoked salmon. Then you've got a wonderful smoked salmon potato latke. So the cream, as the potato latke is cooked,
uh-huh.
you know, the whole thing's going to melt down gently because the cream's going to get warm. And I think it's a delicious little thing.
extraordinary latkes with lox.
Hmm.
What do you think of that, Tom?
Hmm.
Hmm.
I'm a purist when it comes to latkes.
Oh, is,
what, is, what does that mean to you?
I mean, to me, I like to shred the Yukon Gold potato, right? And I like to shred the onion into a bowl, and then I squeeze some of that juice out because it's a little wet. And then I like to get a pan full of bacon fat.
That is, that is called crossing the, crossing the borders. I'm with you.
I'm baptized.
With you.
What do I know about?
I said
what do I know about Jewish
Billy
food?
My Billy doesn't have a religion.
I'm when it comes to food, I'm what is it? Agnostic when you don't have a religion when it comes to food, right? So anyway, so I bacon fat and butter, and I put them in, but I don't pile them in. I like to I like spreading it out so I get lacy edges that get nice and crisp.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
I mean, I think a potato like kale, or even a potato.
For the holiday, you don't want to use like duck fat or something that's
sure,
a little more.
Sure, duck fat would be awesome.
There we go. It's a little more.
Yeah, duck fat would be delicious.
Schmaltz, chicken fat, you know?
Yeah. Schmaltz. That,
you know, anything like that.
Now we're talking. That's
Are you against bacon?
I love bacon, but it's not very kosher for the holidays.
Well, it says ordinary to extraordinary is the name of the segment.
Yeah, but it's still vodka.
I'm not sure. I thought I'd remind you.
All right.
I thought I'd remind you of that.
It might be a big discovery for some.
It might be a big discovery for some.
So anyway, the point that I'm trying to make is that you get the fat medium hot.
Yes.
And you don't just put a ball. Like that shouldn't look like a matzo ball, right?
It
should
be
thin and lacy and get crunchy around the edges.
Correct.
So that when you do put that velvety cured salmon on top or the custardy sour cream.
You have a texture.
That you have a texture change.
Exactly.
No applesauce amongst the two of you for the latkes.
Not unless it's on the side. I don't like piling stuff on top of them.
I'm not a big applesauce on that case. But another thing you could do if you really feel spendy is a big spoon of caviar on top of that latke. That would be
mighty swell. Yeah, at Seattle Caviar would be quite happy if everyone went out there.
I think that's what they recommend for diet.
Mm-hmm.
If you can afford it, a glass of champagne, potato latke, and a big spoon of caviar.
So apparently, all you need to make a extraordinary is to put a baptized Catholic on the stove.
Is that what
it takes? Because we will use bacon fat.
Oh, Bubby. Bubby would be so upset with you right now.
Grandma Pearl would be slapping me upside the head.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, next up, your questions on gravies, brownies, and more on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. Sarah's here today. We're at the Hot Stove Society. Tina is still, our producer is still in Hawaii. And I'm sure she's going to come back and say she's broke. It's like, well, you just spent 10 days in Hawaii. What do you think? I was in Hawaii this last weekend.
You were?
Yeah, I went Friday afternoon and came back Sunday night.
You'd like to go just one day to Hawaii.
It was two pretty sunny days. Played four rounds of golf in 2 days. Won my five bets.
You won five bets.
Yeah, I won $50 and 11 cocktails.
Oh, my goodness. The cocktail
I think the 11 cocktails are a lot better than the $50.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's
I had a good weekend.
Well, sounds like fun. We're happy to have you
back.
Thank
you. Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Was it nice and, was it nice and sunny?
Yeah. Look at that.
Wow.
Look at.
I'm showing for you in the radio audience that cannot see me. I'm sorry about that. But I do have a luscious red line across my...
Yeah, you're a little like two-thirds Neapolitan ice cream. You're the strawberry and the vanilla right there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah it is.
So thanks. Sarah's going to put that on Facebook in case you wanted to see my sunburn line.
That beautiful, beautiful sunburn.
What are our questions?
All right. We went to our Facebook page, Seattle Kitchen, and we asked you if you had any culinary questions. This first one comes from someone with a really awesome name, Cornelius Balderson. Would like to know, holidays are upon us, and that means many holiday dinners. What, in your opinion, is the best way to make a bone-in prime rib roast extraordinary? I've been cooking it the same way every year and looking to bring it to the next level. Tom, this sounds like a question
right up your alley.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, you talk about how you do it.
Are you coming to my prime rib class on the 22nd?
You know, I could use a class on prime rib.
I think Thierry and I could both use a class on prime rib.
I could use a slab of prime rib.
I don't recall the last time I cooked an entire prime rib on the bone. Mm-hmm. I cooked you know, chop, but I don't remember the last time I cooked an entire prime rib. I mean, it's a serious investment as a cook, especially a home cook, to buy a whole prime rib that's going to cost you some serious dough, and to cook this with a, you know, a fierce move into the kitchen and go, I'm going to cook this perfect, you know. That's a little bit of a taken. You have to be very careful. I would say, first thing and most importantly, buy a thermometer so you can know what's going on inside your roast without any doubt whatsoever. So take the doubt out of the game. Don't act like you're Superman on the first day. And
well, I think the first thing, when you're, if you really want a prime rib, you have to buy prime meat.
Correct.
So that is the number one thing. Almost everybody sells choice prime rib, in quotations. Right. It's really, if it's choice, it's a rib roast.
Spend
it's not a prime rib.
Yeah, spend the money and buy the right piece.
So there's a big difference there.
Right.
If you're buying a prime rib, basically on the bone, a whole one, you're looking at probably a $300 investment.
Yep.
Because it's about $30 a pound for prime, and they run between 10 and 14 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a $300 plus investment. And then...
But I understand why people want to do it this time of year. It's the time of giving and hosting parties, and it's a very generous, hospitable thing to do if you're hosting something.
And also, there is seven bones, but there is not just seven portions.
Correct.
Let's clear that up.
Correct. And so I think the thing to do is just go fairly low and slow. You can start it at 425 for maybe 30 minutes and then take it down to 300 or 325 until it's about 110, 115 degrees in the center of the roast. At that point, you pull it out, and you're going to have to let it rest for 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it'll drip some juices. You want to save all of those. You want to, if you're making a gravy, which I don't really recommend for prime rib, it's plenty rich. Then I would say, you know, save the fat in the pan and make you a little pan gravy. But outside of that, I think it's better off with a finishing salt. So that you're just taking the lusciousness of the roast, accenting it with maybe a little rosemary salt or a little herb salt or a little smoke salt.
What I recommend
But the thing is that you have to, you're going to season the outside. I have a roast rub, but whatever you want to do, season the outside. But when you slice it, you've got a whole area of pork or beef roast that's not seasoned.
Right.
So when you serve it, you have to put the seasoning salt on or it's just going to taste blah.
Right. And I would say also one thing that I love to do when I do prime rib roast like that, or at least in a chop, is to finish it with a bunch of fresh chopped herbs, a little bit of olive oil, and a little bit of salt. And that's what I put a brush on top of the meat, so then your meat is now getting a nice fresh, and also some zest of citrus.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have this little gramorata idea where you just put that on top of your meat, and that totally perks it up.
Yep, I agree.
And gives it some personality.
So that's what I would do. And then if you want to really just change it around, you take those seven bones that Terry talked about, and you can make tomahawk chops out of those, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to relieve the bone of some of its fat cap, so it has a little, maybe an inch or two relief on the top of it, so it's just the bone sticking out. I like a tomahawk chop because you're getting so much more sear on the meat than you are in a big slab of prime rib where essentially it's just warm beef in the center, right? So there's really not much caramelization going on. So at a tomahawk chop, you're getting a sear on both sides. And that's, to me, that's the ultimate
more
way.
More personality, yeah.
In my class here, we do a choice rib next to a prime rib next to a tomahawk chop. And we have all three taste on your plate at the same time. So you can really tell where your flavor is coming
from.
When
is that class again?
22nd. It's sold out, though.
Oh, great. When is the next one?
Next December 22nd.
Next year.
They're very, as you can imagine, they're very expensive classes to put on.
Yes.
A whole prime rib, like I said, is $350, and a whole Wagyu rib is over $500.
Right.
I mean, it's a very expensive class to put on.
But if you're a meat lover, if this is something that you're going to tackle at any given point in your life, you know, I think it's a really great investment because where else are you going to try all those things side by side?
I think you should make a video and sell it.
All right, the next question comes from Cheryl Roger Osborne. I don't drink wine, but I like cooking with it. When I go into my local wine shop and ask for a... lots of question marks there. Whatever wine they find out I'm going to cook with, if they direct me to the cheapest or tell me I'd better off picking a lower-end wine up at the store. I don't need good wine. That's what they're telling her. Do I use a good drinking wine, or do I just pick up whatever is cheap at the store? My last escaped escapade, is what she's trying to say there, was for a Burgundy for Burgundy mushrooms and a rosé champagne for cake. Thank you.
Well, that sounds good.
This comes up all the time.
This comes up
often. Yeah, this comes up a lot. So I think you should go with what your wallet allows you to do. That's a number one drive. I think that's what most people do. But don't go buy a $2 5-gallon bucket of water of wine, because that's not going to be good for your cooking.
But even if your wallet allows you to buy, let's say, a $60 bottle of wine
for dinner,
cook with, I don't know that that's the right.
Let's just say that $60 is a bottle of Burgundy.
Yeah.
But you need a whole bottle for beef bourguignon also.
Mm-hmm.
Then I would buy a nice Bourgogne village or something
which
of that nature.
Which would be like
nature.
$15 to $20.
$20, you know. Yeah. So, yeah, you're still buying a decent wine, right. But you're not necessarily putting a $60 bottle of wine in there. So, yeah, I don't think it's necessary. Typically, when I use wine, I'm not using that much, mm-hmm. and I always use what I'm drinking.
Yeah. And if she doesn't drink, which it sounds like she does not, then save it for the guests, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Julia Child had a very famous quote saying that she loves to cook with wine, and sometimes she even puts it in her food.
That's why we love her so much. Okay. Sarah wants to know, I want to make more meat-free lunches, but quickly get sick of salads. What are some easy meat-free lunches that I can pack up and bring to work?
Grain salad. That's the other one.
Well, it's a famous line from my big fat Greek wedding. If you're a vegetarian, just have the lamb.
There you go.
Remember that line?
I do.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Good.
You'll have the lamb then.
I think
Cornelius Balderson. I want that name.
Me too.
Up next, it's Chef Bridget Charters and Magnus Nielsen. And we're going to get a little listen in on that, because she did that when he was in town on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Hot Stove Society and the Seattle Kitchen Show. Thank you for joining us. Chef Bridget Charters, one of the instructors here at the Hot Stove, is going to... you had a chance to talk to Magnus Nielsen?
I did. It was fabulous.
He's got a new book. Tell us about it.
Remember the Nordic cookbook that
mm-hmm.
he had?
Mm-hmm.
So during that time, and he said it was about 3 years of 3 years plus of kind of research and traveling around and just exploring, he ended up with all of these baking. It's such a big part of their heritage mm-hmm. and tradition in Scandinavia. So he was like, oh, my goodness, this is a whole different book. So here's the book.
Lovely. Let's listen in.
Welcome back to Seattle. I know you're here for a short period of time. How's it feel to be back?
Thank you. I mean, it feels very good to be back. It always feels good to be back here.
With the baking book, I read an article that you had your wife, and it sounds like your mother, involved with the production of the recipes. Is that...
Yeah, my mom wasn't really involved, but Tove, she did a lot of the recipe development for this book. I mean, about 300 of the recipes. So this documentary book, which means that all of the recipes are coming from someone else. They're not our recipes, or they're not my recipes. But what you have to do with them is to make sure that they are consistent, so that all of the biscuit recipes render roughly the same amount of biscuits, and all of the jam recipes render roughly the same amount of finished jam. And that's a lot of work, and you need to be very meticulous when you're doing that.
Tom has folks from all over the Puget Sound that listen to the radio show. Would this book appeal to him? Because your last book was amazing and fascinating and a bit esoteric. For we chefs, it was just eye candy for us. So do you want this baking book to appeal to all folks in terms of baking? And what were your thoughts when you put this massive baking book together?
First of all, I don't look at the books as, you know, a separate process. It's like one process that spanned over 6 years. After 3 years, the first result came out, which was the Nordic cookbook,
right.
And now it finishes with the Nordic baking book. And they are documentary. They are a snapshot of what people actually bake in their homes all through the Nordic region right now. That's how I hope that they're going to be used, you know, as books to explain to people a bit more about what Nordic culture and baking culture is. And hopefully people will also bake from them. Because, I mean, the recipes are incredibly well worked through. And the thing with most of these recipes that we sort of take for granted today, they were first published between 30 and 60 years ago. And that applies to, like, almost all of the recipes. I mean, if you look for a recipe for potato gratin online, you know, they're kind of all the same. And they were first published between 30 and 60 years ago. And funnily enough, people know different things about cooking now than they did then. So a lot of these recipes, especially on the baking side, where you have to be very precise, they contain a lot of assumed knowledge. It can be a thing like everyone knew 50 years ago that for a recipe where you fold wheat flour into whipped eggs, you know, you need to sift it in. People today might not know this. Therefore, they have a high chance of actually failing with their recipes that they find. So we work through all of the recipes very meticulously so that there's no assumed knowledge left. You don't have to have like prior cultural knowledge about Nordic baking culture to have a good sort of chance to succeed with these.
You know, it's interesting here in the United States. I feel as though our heritage is kind of slipping away from a culinary perspective just because there's so many generations. I mean, we have so much more access. I remember the last time you were here, we were talking about that conversation with how foods have morphed. And do you feel that way with pastry, or is this hope to kind of seize all this beautiful history because it's amazing?
I don't think that we have any chance of controlling food culture and, like, preserving food culture, actually, because that's just a... Sometimes today we look upon culture as, like, a roadmap to how we want it to be, which it's not. Culture is the end result of all of the things that we do. What we should do is to make sure that we document things and record stuff that can otherwise be forgotten. And that's not the same thing as forcing people to actually practice culture that's become obsolete. Food culture has to be allowed to evolve. I think an interesting thing is that, I mean, most people in the Western world today have a more varied and diverse diet than they had 10 years ago, much because we have access to much more information. So on an individual level, we are more diverse in terms of food culture than we've ever been. But if you take all of food culture and you just lump it together, I think we are less diverse than we've ever been because we all share the same information. Yes, a couple of decades ago, that wasn't the case. And people sharing the same information means more access to diversity on an individual level, but it means ultimately less diversity on a larger scale because people do more of the same stuff since they have the same information.
When I was looking at the book, seemed to be some beautiful, poignant moments in where I felt like, oh, this is disappearing a little bit, that history. There were some beautiful things. Did you feel that a little bit, like it was slipping away, or is it all alive and well?
I mean, that's the way I saw it before I started with this project, before I started the research. And as I said before, it's the one research process. It's the same research, and it's been ongoing for both of the books. And now I don't see it that way anymore, because I've just sort of come to the realization that it's not about slipping away. It's about things changing, and they should change. And they've always changed and will always continue to change. And the important thing is not to try to preserve food culture in a bubble. The important thing is to document what was there and what is there so that it doesn't disappear if people stop practicing certain expressions of food culture. Because it's so easy to adapt or to adopt a view that everything old should always be considered better and it should be the way we continue doing things in the future. But, I mean, that's not always the best solution.
How do we honor your book in terms of baking? Just a go for it and grab our regular ingredients, or is there something you'd recommend?
I mean, I think that's actually one of the greatest things with food culture is that it does adapt to the circumstances where it's practiced. And if you take any recipe from that book and you bake it here in Seattle, it's not going to be the same as when I baked it back home in Sweden in my kitchen. And that's the way it should be. Because food culture shouldn't be, you shouldn't, you know, aim to replicate exactly what others do. You should make it into your own. And yes, something that, you know, like changing the location to another part of the world will inevitably affect the outcome of a recipe. Whether that depends on things like climate and you know, humidity quotes and stuff like that, or perhaps just that the flour is different, or that the sugar here is cane, ours are beet. All of these things, they will affect the outcome. I think that's just amazing. So a recipe that you bake, yours is not going to be the same as mine. It's going to work, but it's not going to be the same.
I mean, we have all range of cooks that listen to the radio show, and when they're baking, do you guys have a helpline that they can call into or email? You know, I'm sure there are going to be things where there's going to be shifts where it just doesn't seem quite right. This is an international book. Did you address that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the whole book has been tested by recipe testers in various parts of the world. same thing still applies, as I said before. I mean, they're never going to turn out exactly the same. And there's always going to be nuances, either imposed by the circumstances where you're baking, with ingredients and so on, or just by the baker himself or herself as well. And that's, I mean, isn't that the great thing with cooking as well, that we can allow ourselves this? I think with baking, it's interesting because, I mean, if you follow a well-made recipe to the dot, you will end up with a decent result. It's going to be good. I think that there's both a danger with these detailed, precise recipes, but also like something that's very interesting, because it means that baking is probably the most easy field in cooking as a beginner to achieve a decent result in. But it's at the same time the most difficult field in cooking to become intuitive in. That I think that most of us, even those who don't cook much, they can taste something and they can sort of say to themselves that, I think this needs a bit more salt. And to achieve that type of intuitive feeling for baking, I think is much harder. And there are not very many of us who can have that, you know.
Sounds as though your baking book is relaxed that way. You want your readers to relax when they're doing it.
I mean, I think it can be both. It's very precise because it also provides gram measurements. But, I mean, I think that people should just take the recipes in the baking book the same way they should in any cookbook. It's a rough roadmap on how you should do it. You shouldn't be too strict about it, you know. But if you're beginning with a recipe that you haven't done before, I think that is always a good thing to skip the imperial measurements and go for the gram measurements, the metric measurements. And then, you know, as you've done the recipe a couple of times, perhaps just not following it so precisely anymore, but, you know, starting to work with it a little bit more intuitively.
So the last time you were in, we had a fun event. At the time, you were super interested in hot dogs. And is there something new that you're working on?
I mean, the latest sort of bigger project that I've jumped on is that I bought quite a large apple orchard. And it's an historic orchard. It's a beautiful place and something that's very fascinating to learn about. I think it's going to be very interesting for the next few years to follow that and see where it actually ends up, you know, what we end up doing with it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Magnus. And hopefully you get a chance to enjoy some of Seattle before you jet off to the next location.
Thanks for having me again.
At the end of the day, you would buy the book.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I mean, that kind of stuff fascinates me. Mm-hmm. I mean, his Nordic cookbook was amazing. And so it's fascinating to look into that society from baking, from cooking. I mean, it's a beautiful book. It's amazing. And those in the Northwest area have huge Scandinavian traditions. And this book is a must buy.
All right. Thanks for doing that. We appreciate it here at the Hot Stove Society and Seattle Kitchen Show. Up next, KDO is hosting a dinner party with the same ingredient in every course. On Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. It's a very exciting time here. I've never been more excited on the show than I am right now.
Really?
Yeah. Wow, what's going on?
We're going to go to Katie's house for dinner.
That's right.
And we're celebrating. It's Hanukkah, so we're celebrating with the only Jew I know.
That's not true.
You know plenty.
I mean, I know because she's running our show.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's true.
You are our guest.
I am both a guest and a Jew. I got it all down. You check all the boxes for this particular dinner, Sarah.
My daughter's boyfriend, Benjamin, is Jewish. And we're having him for latkes this week.
Oh, that sounds lovely. Yeah. That's sweet that you're adopting some different cultures. We are having a dinner party at my place. And as we do, we use the same ingredient in every course. And I assume because Sarah wrote this show, this must be one of her favorite ingredients.
I was trying to think of what you see a lot of in December. And it was clementines. And I was like, I'd rather have blood oranges.
Okay, cool, yes. Citrus is big during this time of year.
Good call.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Very good call.
Yes, love blood oranges.
Tom and Terry are very excited about this ingredient.
The other one would have been kumquats.
Mm. And it goes perfectly with your red hair.
Oh, yeah. I'm always planning for the red hair. Gotta make a match.
You gotta match the food to the hair. Yep, gotta match it. All right, so that is what we're gonna do for this dinner party. Blood oranges in every single course. Our guest is Sarah, so she'll be judging your dishes as you go. Who would like to take on the cocktail?
I'm gonna start with the cocktail because I think I get an idea there.
All right.
We're gonna make a bloody Kheer.
Do you know what that is?
Nope, no idea.
You know Kir Royale?
I've heard of it.
Champagne and raspberry liquor. Mm. Instead, we're going to do blood orange juice. We're going to juice some blood orange and put that in your champagne. So it's like a mimosa, but except it's with blood orange. More citrusy, less sugar, because blood orange have a tendency to be more acidic and less sweet.
Are you going to throw any Kir in there, too?
I'm going to put a little bit of that pulp, you know, the orange segments. I'm going to put a couple of orange segments in your glass, and then beautiful little champagne and some blood orange juice.
But you're going to keep them in like a supreme, right? You're going to keep it segment?
Yeah. Yeah. And then just that's your first glass of champagne as you walk in.
Mm. Sounds like a good way to start the night.
I'm going to keep the candied slices for the end because I got an idea for dessert, too.
Well, you're not on dessert. You're on the entree.
Okay.
Remember, we rotate courses?
Yes. Well, okay. We'll see. We'll see where we go through this.
Whoops.
I'm going to make a blood orange and avocado salad.
Ooh.
Just because I like that combination of that tart citrus along with the fatty avocado. And since romaine lettuce is still in question, we're going to use butter lettuce, Boston butter lettuce.
Mm.
And we're just going to do a nice little... if you can find the smallest head possible, and then take out the core and then rebuild the head onto your plate kind of so that it opens up. Terry, I know, knows how to do that. It's very typical for Boston lettuce to be kind of rebuilt as a broken out flower. The whole head turns into kind of
a rose, like a little green rose.
And then we're going to put in the sliced avocado in the center, garnish with the supremes of blood oranges, toasted hazelnuts, and then a little blood orange vinaigrette.
Wow.
On top of that.
What do you think of that, Sarah?
That sounds lovely. You know, I can't think of anything you're going to say during this entire dinner that I'm going to be like, oh, that's terrible. So far, off to a great start.
Yeah, I was thinking about deconstructing a potato latke.
Ooh.
You know, and just taking those potatoes shreds and deep frying those and garnishing my salad with crispy potato latke.
Mm. It's not too late, Tom. You can do that.
I just did it.
There you go. All right, good.
Yeah. I like this. I was thinking of doing that. Yeah. I just did it.
All right. You've done it.
Now we've got the crunch to go with the creamy avocado. Oh,
it's perfect.
Gilding the lily.
Look at, I got chills.
So I'm going to do.
Me too. Yeah. We're all chilly. All right. Thierry, your entree.
For the entree, I'm going to do a whole duck roasted. And in the cavities, I'm going to fill, obviously, guess what? Slices of blood orange, rosemary, little sage. You know, just like little stuffing inside the duck, but not packed in, just loose. And then I'm going to put the duck in the oven, super high heat, 500 degrees or 450, whatever how high your oven can go, and give it a nice, beautiful, crispy skin on the duck for about, it's probably going to take about 40, 45 minutes. And then get your duck super crispy. And then at the end, I'm going to make a glaze of blood.
Wait, Chef. Can I just stop you right there? You're saying cook the duck for 45 minutes at 500. And not, you said 500 or 450.
Well, whatever you can get,
oven. And you don't turn it down to finish it at all?
You're going to definitely look at it during the time it's cooking.
And then, so what if it's still rare?
Well, then you keep cooking it until...
At 500?
Oh my gosh, Mom and Dad are fighting at
your dinner. I'm just curious. You didn't finish that.
He has a point. This happens all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, in my home, my oven is not calibrated properly. It's a 1952 Roper. And I'm always challenged with I put it at 300 and then I read the thermometer in there and it's 425. So there's definitely some issues when you're baking, maybe not quite that drastic. But so anyway, yeah, if it's not cooked all the way, you turn down the heat to 350 and then you keep cooking it. You want that duck to be cooked all the way.
So not, 155?
I would say 145 to 150.
Okay.
And then you let it rest. But what I was going to say is before the end, before it comes out of the oven for the last 5-10 minutes, you have to brush it a little glaze of blood orange right on top of the skin. And that's going to make a beautiful, crispy little skin with a glaze that's going to be totally cooked on top of that skin. It's going to be delicious, I think. Mm. Take the duck, let it rest, obviously. And then portion the whole thing up. And then we're going to serve that, obviously. We've already used a little potato, but I think I'm going to make some nice latke with that. And on top of those latkes, I'm going to do... sauteed caramelized onion right on top of that. Slice the duck, put right on top of that so everything is mounted, kind of like a salad idea. And then I'm going to make a reduced duck stock with all the bones. I'm going to make a little stock. I'm going to put some chicken stock on top of that, vegetable. Reduce it down and then finish with blood orange caramel. So it's a sweet and sour.
I only have 2 minutes for dessert now, chef.
Well, that's okay. I can get the dessert too if you want. I can make the dessert in 1 minute. Anyway, a nice little glaze on top of your duck. So I think I lost you somewhere along the line, by the way.
Yeah, her eyes have glazed over.
I was too busy thinking about glazing that duck.
I know.
Yeah, you can keep
now
it
look at her eyes.
Glaze.
Okay, so in a big saute pan, we're going to put 1/8-inch sliced blood oranges right across the orange, right? Peel everything. Take the little plastic tag off of it, but everything else. We're going to put those on the bottom with a little bit of white sugar, a little bit of butter, and then on top of that, we're going to put fennel. And on top of that, we're going to slice fresh figs. And then we're going to cook there until the blood oranges dehydrate and caramelize on the bottom. And then we're going to put a little pot brisé, a little pie dough over top of that. And throw it in the oven. And we're going to have a blood orange, fennel, and fig tatin, tart tatin.
Oh,
yeah.
That sounds so good.
And just churn it out. It'll be all caramelized. By the time your pie dough is cooked 20 minutes later, the whole thing will kind of melt together. And you're going to serve that with a little blood orange whip. So you're just simply taking a little bit of the zest from the blood orange and make a little whipped cream out of it. And we're done.
Can I send Sarah home with a gift?
Yes.
A Hanukkah gift?
Sarah looks, Sarah's looking so lovingly right now.
That's what I was going to do.
I'm going to send her home with some sufganiyot. Is that how we pronounce it?
Sufganiyot.
Filled with a little blood orange marmalade.
And I'm going to send you home with some blood orange madeleine.
Oh, man, warm. I'm just getting sent home with everything.
We love you, Sarah. We want you to have a happy holiday.
It's a dinner party to remember in your honor.
Absolutely.
Happy Hanukkah.
Oh, thank you.
I'm going to light all the candles, too. It's like you're going to all eight. Is it 8 candles?
It is 8 candles.
Yeah, I'm going to light them all.
All right, thank you.
Up next, it's our Taste of the Week on Cairo Radio.
Make it 9. We have a long week to go.
97.3 FM. Hey, it's time to come back into our kitchen on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rotiro, the chef in a hat.
And I'm Katie O.
Sarah, if you were with us in the last segment, Sarah is still swooning over her dinner that we made out of blood oranges for her. Your eyes did glaze over when Thierry was talking about the glaze for the duck.
To be fair, that was like 5 minutes on glaze.
I know. I'm glazing. All right, it's time for our Taste of the Week. Katie O, we're going to let you lead this one off.
All right.
I will say, though, in the next hour, we have Brittany Bartleben coming to talk about Yule logs. You don't want to miss that. And we're going to talk about sweet potatoes. And my taste happens to be something about a sweet potato,
really?
Too.
Really?
And then Food for Thought Tasty Trivia is going to wrap up this hour.
That's right. My Taste of the Week, much like one of our listeners who had the question about lunches and what to have for lunch and how to have a non-meaty lunch, I think about this too. I work over on the Capitol Hill, that area, that neighborhood, and so I'm always on the lookout when I don't plan my lunches. And I have become obsessed with some savory oats at the juice box up there on Capitol Hill.
Mm.
They are a miso oatmeal, steel-cut oats, with this charred ribbons of kale and a fried egg, and they finish it with black sesame and some seeds, and it is the most delicious thing.
Wow,
I've become
good.
Obsessed. I'm very
sounds
inspired
very
by these Ooh. By these miso oats.
Mm.
Mm. Keeping it healthy.
I kind of like the idea.
Yeah.
You know, normally, I don't love those kind of things, but because I always think of oats as being horse food.
No, I think you would really like this because it's got that savory. It's just miso. You know, it's that flavor.
I know.
That
I love miso
flavor, and then you have that kale that they sear really hard, so it has that kind of charred, delicious flavor to it. And then
no,
you've
I
got a
see,
sunny
yeah.
side up egg. It's
nice.
Yeah, exactly, and it's a great. Middle of the day, you still have a lot more work to go. You still need a lot of energy, so you don't want to feel heavy and weighed down.
And plus, they created that texture, you know, the different layer of texture, the miso, the charred kale. That sounds delicious.
Yeah. All right. That's my taste of the week.
Lovely.
I'm going to go with the went to a couple of friends of ours this weekend, and they made a tagine of chicken tagine with obviously onions, and beautiful lemon preserve. It was so scrumptious. And I'm still tasting it, I guess. It was really, really good. And little vegetables around it and some sauteed kale. Obviously, a little bit off the, you know, just being more local that way. But just to balance the meal. And it was just fantastic. The the flavor that was in that chicken. You know, when you make a chicken tagine, you cook it super, super slow.
Do you brown it first and then cook it
yeah,
slow?
Yeah, she seared it. She did sear all the legs. She used nothing but legs mm-hmm. of chicken and seared them up and then put them on top of that caramelized, gentle cooked onion, not mm-hmm. caramelized. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, spices, turmeric and coriander. And oh my God, it was absolutely flawless.
And did she cook it in the typical tagine pot with a conical lid
yes.
on it?
Yes, okay. Very slowly on the fire. And she did it on the stove. Mm-hmm. And then she transferred that into beautiful Le Creuset mm-hmm. pot that was to put on the table. That was really delicious. The whole thing was fantastic. I put actually a picture of it on Facebook because I was so enamored
so
with
smitten.
It. Yeah, and you know, those are the dishes that we don't think about very often in terms of, oh, what am I going to make? I got chicken. What am I going to make? And usually you always fall back on your own recipe and the same recipe over and over. Mm-hmm. This is a great idea to start. You know, tagine is a great dish. Especially on a Sunday football game, you know, you just put on this thing on the stove and then you forget about it for 3, 4, 5 hours and then you have this marvelous dish when you're done.
Yeah. Now, is it typical, that's Moroccan, right?
Right.
Are they Moroccan?
Yeah.
Is it typical to serve a harissa on the side, like as a brightening paste at the end, or is it always incorporated?
No, in this one, there was no harissa on the side.
No harissa at all. No, so that's more of an American thing.
We all love harissa, but there was no harissa on this one.
And she didn't serve it like as a condiment either? No.
No, this was just the tagine itself. The focus was on actually the beautiful chicken that was totally unrobbed with the glaze from the onion, the mm-hmm. juice from the onion and the chicken stock that was in there. And then the finishing of all the preserved lemon and lots of chopped parsley. And that was very simply done. And it was clean. That's the part that I really love. It was a beautiful, clean flavor. It was not millions of flavor. You definitely tasted the onion that was melting. And you tasted the chicken that was seared. And the obviously the spices, you know. And that was yummy. And the preserved lemon definitely is one of those... touch. To me, I think preserved lemon is like an umami kind of idea. You know, if you do it right and you put it at the right time into your dish, it gets that beautiful flavor. You don't want to, you know, overdo it, but I think it brings a nice flavor in your dish. And then finish with nice little sea salt on top. Fabulous.
Sounds luscious.
Tom, what was your taste of the week?
I took home a loaf of our seasonal bread from the Dahlia Bakery, as I like to do when it comes out. This right now, it's a yam and hazelnut, I believe, bread.
Oh.
I think that's the nut in there. And it's got a nice hearty crust on it, which I love, that darker crust. And then I just took it and made toast out of it, right in my toaster. It also would be good pan-fried in with some olive oil. And then I put on goat butter. And my sister, or I think it was my sister that was here, that didn't eat dairy, but she could eat goat mm-hmm. milk. So we put goat butter on it and just a fresh grind of pepper and a little bit of smoked sea salt.
Yeah.
And it was just, those simple flavors.
Yeah. Now,
those simple flavors when you put more butter than you should put on anything. And it just drips as you take a bite, it drips down to the side of your mouth. That's a luscious thing.
That is a very luscious thing.
Yeah,
tell me more about this bread. This bread sounds delightful.
It is delightful. It's a little wetter than I was expecting it to be. So when I toasted it, I toasted hard.
Yeah.
Because of the potato, it caramelized beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. You know, I love that crisp caramelized or even burnt edge on the toast.
Me too.
And so that's really kind of what made it for me was being able to get to that edge.
Oof.
And then when you mix that kind of burnt crusty edge, same way I like my pizza, right? I like a dark crusted pizza.
As do I.
Yeah. So... anyway, it was delicious, and it sounds like we all had lovely taste last week.
Oh, this time of year, it's easy to have good taste. Everybody brings something.
Well, in the summer, you just need a peach, right? I mean, in the summer, you don't need anything. But this time of year, it tends to be a little bit more mm-hmm. Activity in developing our taste. Okay, speaking of sweet potatoes, one potato, two potato, one sweet potato, and all of the above. What is the difference between a yam and a sweet potato? We're going to find out mm-hmm. on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm Tom Douglas.
Yep,
everyone's busy eating. Can't applaud anymore.
That's right.
It's Cairo Radio. We're here at the Hot Stove Society. Lots and lots of Christmas parties happening here this month. And I'm doing two classes mm-hmm. Before Christmas. I'm doing the crepe cake class. with 5 different crab cake presentations. It's a little expensive, as you can imagine.
I can imagine.
It's $150. But there's a taste of everything. And I'm doing a prime rib class.
Let's talk
That's
about...
even more expensive.
You know, it's not very far off. I mean, a crab is around $30 a pound for meat or more, depending on the size of the cut that you want, right? So,
can we talk about classes at the Hot Stove for just a minute? Because I feel like everyone is on the hunt for their holiday gifts, maybe even right now. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're driving around frantically looking for things. But a cooking class and an experience is a great gift. So what is the range of prices to come here to the Hot Stove? It's not all $150 all the time.
No, I would say the usual, typical price is $90.
$90.
And that includes either some sort of dinner or at least taste with everything that you make, or a take-home, depending if it's a hands-on class or if it's a demo-style class. Mm-hmm. My classes are always inclusive of dinner, so they're a little more expensive. And they also include wine. I can't imagine not having wine during my class. And so I just feel like that's what I have to do with my class.
What kind of Tom Douglas class would it be without a little glass of something?
That's kind of how they work. And it is. So we have classes on Saturday morning. You know, Xiao Ching Chow, I think twice a month, does her dumpling class, which is fairly difficult to get into. She's got a good book, too, that... called Chinese Soul Food, I believe is the name of her book.
But that's the beauty of classes, though, is because I think they're probably very popular because people want to know the tactile qualities of actually folding those dumplings. It's hard to sometimes discern just with a book or not having someone helping and guiding you along the way.
You know what surprised me about the classes here is that you'll get groups. Like today at our radio show, we have some groups of ladies who came together, right, or this and that, and that's what you'll see at our classes. But you see a lot of couples and a lot of singles at our classes, too.
That's right.
And so if you're a dude and you buy your girlfriend or wife or lover or whoever it is a class, and you buy yourself a ticket at the same time, it's very sexy.
It's a very cool date
it's
night.
It's totally sexy.
I mean, I would have
been together,
charmed.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff.
Nice. Have a glass of wine.
Wait, lots of things are giving me goosebumps today. I'm very emotional today, obviously, yeah. But I think it's sexy to cook together. You put on some nice music, all that kind of stuff.
Maybe that could be the tagline for Hot Stove Society. It gives me goosebumps.
Marketing genius over here. All right, let's talk about sweet potatoes, particularly sweet potatoes versus yams and what you get out there in the marketplace. There is some confusion around it. Tom?
Well, if you want me to start, I did a little research for an event that I was doing a couple of weeks ago, and really the only place I've seen yams are at Wajamaya.
I agree with you. That is also the only place where I've ever seen a true yam.
Which has kind of got a pebbly skin, I would say. It's got a little bumps on it. And
it's got whiskers sometimes.
Yeah, and it's if you go to a grocery store, like at the QFC or Met Market or any place like that, they don't carry yams. They say it. But it's not what is, in real life, a yam. Mm-hmm. And typically what they try to do is the light-skinned ones are yams and the dark-skinned ones are sweet potatoes. Or you go to the store next door and it's just the opposite.
Right.
And what it really is, they're all sweet potatoes.
They're all sweet potatoes.
Just different kinds of sweet potatoes.
Get it.
There's 100 different, probably more, kinds of sweet potatoes.
Right. So. And they just range in color, right, from that kind of beigey, yellowish
garnet
color. Yeah, all the way to the garnet and the deeper oranges.
Or from not Hiroshima. What are the
Fujiyama.
No. The
I know what
purple
you're talking
ones.
About. The purple yams.
What are they
from
called?
Japan.
From the prefecture in Japan.
Feeling like a bad Japanese?
I know.
You're all right now.
Okinawa sweet potatoes.
There
Okinawa.
We go.
Okinawa sweet potatoes.
Okinawa sweet potatoes. There you go.
So, I mean, there's all kinds. And so typically for me, I like to take them in either if the skin looks nice, I will leave the skin on, just cut circles. I'll pan fry them in tons of duck fat and butter.
Why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't you? Mm-hmm. Especially the harder they are, the more fat they're going to soak up. So the wetter they are, right, the more they'll cook super fast. And the thing is, if you want to roast them, say, get nice crispy wedges, even if you have wet ones, put them on a cookie sheet, coat them in olive oil and butter and salt and pepper, and put them in the oven. And as soon as they get soft, people tend to want to pull them.
Yeah.
And that's they're only halfway done.
It's a little bit like mushrooms.
Yeah.
Or
cauliflower.
Let it go for a second.
They're halfway done. Yes, they are cooked. You are right. But if you let them go another 20 minutes and get dry out even more, then they firm back up. and become these nice crispy little outsides with creamy insides and a delicious roasted sweet potato.
I like to bake mine whole, just like a baked potato,
yeah.
And just wait till they're totally soft and then cut a slit right through the skin,
mm-hmm.
and then fill them up with butter and then salt and pepper. I know it sounds kind of funny, doesn't it? Then you take a fork and you just mash it into the skin, mm-hmm. and you serve them just like that.
And you eat the skin.
I eat everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of, a baked potato to me is made to be eaten, the whole thing. When I was a kid, my mom used to throw these in the fire, like if we'd have a fire outside, throw them in the ashes, and then we'd pick them up. And I tell you, they just go like this.
Yeah,
they
just wipe them off.
Wipe them off and here, kid, eat this.
Yeah.
Of course, you had a big mutt of butter on the table, so that was very helpful. I think then butter on potato is probably the most...
Of course. Well,
most
a little...
outrageous thing ever invented.
A little bit of fattiness, I think, what we're talking about here, that olive oil, the butter. I had a delicious sweet potato dish from the little Ma Ono takeout window at Rachel's Ginger Beer, but they took those little, squares of potato, and then they deep fried it. Mm-hmm. So they were really crispy on the outside and very, very luscious and soft on the center. And then it was a coconut... curry paste that they put underneath, so you could kind of dip into that coconut curry paste. It was quite good.
I think very importantly, the butter part is not to be neglected in terms of volume. I think people are scared of oil or fats in general.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're going to do it right. Do it well.
So the idea is eat less potato.
Have the half of the potato, but make sure that you have as much weight in butter as you do in potato.
It's a one-to-one ratio for Terry.
I know it sounds funny, but you know what? Try it once,
yeah,
and you'll never go back.
So
I promise you.
In this article, they talk about how to pick a good sweet potato, mm-hmm. and there is a little bit of a misnomer. It really depends on the kind of potato. So, like for example, the Okinawa purple sweet potatoes, which are probably from Peru, like the rest of the potatoes, but they don't look very good, and it makes you not want to eat the skin. And all you have to do is scrub it. Just scrub it and be done with it and eat it. Or go ahead and peel it and feel fine about yourself. The other ones, like the red garnets or the regular ones that they call yam, like the little lighter ones, just as long as the skin looks edible, looks nice, it doesn't have a lot of pock marks or mold marks.
Right. It's a thin-skinned potato.
Yeah.
Or
it's
yam,
perfectly edible.
Say.
And that's how I would pick a good one, is if it looks good, it's going to taste good. The thing, when you go over to the organic side, it's always going to look a little bit more pocked because we don't use the pesticides on it, right? And critters love sweet potatoes too.
Yeah, it's not fabricated as a beautiful potato, so there will be some deformed and everything. But that the form itself is not the most important. The texture, when you touch your sweet potato, you don't want it to be a mush. When you're buying it, you don't want it to be a soft,
you want it to be firm.
You want it to be very firm.
And as Joni Mitchell said, I don't mind some spots on my apples. I'd rather that than eat some DDT.
Yeah, exactly.
Remember that? From Big Yellow Taxi, right? If you want to get one with your sweet potato, listen to that song on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. We are back in the Seattle kitchen on Cairo Radio. It's Tom Douglas.
Terry Roth, your other chef in the hat.
And Katie O.
People are out and about, having a good time here at the Hot Stove Society. It's time for the Baker's Corner with Chef Brittany Bartleben from the Dahlia Bakery. And today she is joined by Kat.
Hello.
Kat, what's your last name?
Gibbons.
Kat Gibbons. I knew that.
Obviously.
You knew it.
Yules. Yules, younger sister. Brother, niece, granddaughter. And since we're talking about Yule logs, I think it's very appropriate.
Very fitting. Yeah. Kat is our...
You'll love this one.
Oh, no.
Okay, Tom. We have a show to do.
You'll be sorry.
Oh, boy. Rain it in, everybody. Rain it in.
This dessert is just ripe for punnery.
Exactly. This is, we were just talking off air, Kat and I, I'm sure. Brittany, you also probably, I'm assuming, watched the British Bake Off series?
Honey. Of course. The entire most recent season.
Yes, and you know what? I have come to this a little bit late. So all I know about Yule Logs happens to be from one episode where people looked very sad trying to roll their cakes. But you two are experts in this field.
Yes, Kat is our resident Yule log expert. You've made how many every year?
I used to make about 8 a year. I mean, that's
That's a lot. Yeah.
That's a lot to do it for fun. I mean, I make probably 50, so I've got you beat, but I'm getting paid for it.
Yeah, but it's,
exactly.
So Kat, it's not a competition, though. Yeah.
Nope. Let's just do some introductions. Kat is the sales director here at the Hot Stove Society.
Correct.
And has been working with in and out of our company for the last 10 years or so, we'll say.
Yeah,
10 both years. As chef and as front of the house. Mm-hmm. And Brittany has been our pastry chef extraordinaire over at the Dolly Bakery for how long? 7 years now?
I've been with the company for almost 8 years, but mm-hmm. over at the bakery for 4 years.
4 years, yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so this time of year, I mean, you just got done Thanksgiving crush, yes. literally crush. And so now it's time to kind of have a little bit more fun with
yes.
some things that take a little bit more artistic value. And I don't mean that like pumpkin pie isn't.
Sure. Yeah.
But a Yule log is a whole different challenge.
This time of year is all about the cute little things you mm-hmm. get to do on the mm-hmm. Yule logs. And I think that's what makes a Yule log. The little meringue mushrooms, if you want to go all out and do marzipan, little critters, the little design you do on the Yule log to give it that look of like knobby wood.
The marzipan mm-hmm. green leaves.
Yes,
and the
marzipan green leaves, exactly, little cranberries.
The white button mushroom.
Yes, yeah. We use a little red candy for the little cranberries on top. They're right. just precious. And then my absolutely favorite part of the Yule log is we take rosemary, fresh rosemary sprigs, brush them in a little egg white, and then roll them in sugar that we have mixed with a little bit of glitter, a little edible glitter. And so it's just sparkly and beautiful.
Where would somebody find edible glitter?
We call it the Crazy Cake Lady, but there is a cake store in Northgate. I think it's called...
It's 85th and...
Roosevelt, yeah.
Roosevelt,
I think it's called the Home Cake Design. But, I mean, it's the coolest store if you're into
it
this.
It is the coolest yeah. store to go to, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And I say this with love, but the woman who runs the store is crazy. I mean, she's really into what she does, and it's worth it just to go in and take a stroll and dig through her wares. But you can also get that kind of stuff online on Amazon. It's like $5 for a little...
Go to Northgate.
No, go to Northgate.
Go to Northgate. Yeah. Yeah. Part of local yeah. business.
That store
exactly.
is like...
It's not Northgate. 85th and Roosevelt.
Roosevelt, so. Yes.
Yeah, that exactly. store is like going to a 100-year-old library bookstore.
Yes, it's like a just fun adventure to go.
Reminds when you talk about it, reminds me of the old cookie cutter store that used to be in Ballard.
Exactly. I miss that store yeah. so much. I could
totally
just spend hours
too.
In yeah. there. Yeah.
Can we start with the cake itself? I think this is where people get a little bit nervous about the Yule log. Yes, we all look forward to the decorating and the cute little things, but before you can even get there, you've got to make the cake first.
So, Kat, do you have a cake that you go to?
I use the Yule log recipe that my mother gave to me in this cookbook that she gave me in 1996.
A three-ring binder.
Three-ring binder covered in flour and butter.
That's mm-hmm. it's beautiful. Look at it.
For your pleasure.
Only used once.
And, yeah, lightly used. And it's a really simple sponge. I believe it's a fatless sponge, and it's which I know is now a thing. Thank you, Mary Berry and
yeah,
Paul Hollywood.
Exactly.
And just making, I learned at a young age, you know, it's very technique-driven. Beating the yolks and the sugar to ribbon stage, folding in the flour, making sure that you bake it so it doesn't turn to crisp meringue, and rolling it immediately when it comes out of the oven on a powdered sugar tea towel, and then chilling it immediately, which kind of goes against everything you think of when you think of cake baking, of like, oh yeah, when it's hot, roll it, cover it, and cool it down in the fridge.
Yeah, like touching cake at all feels like the antithesis of what you've always been taught with cakes. But in this particular one where you're making, do we call this a Swiss roll in this particular case? I mean, it's the same idea.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. Because if you roll it in the powdered sugar, and the powdered sugar kind of liquefies when it becomes cold, and so it adds a little extra moisture, so it's easy to roll, and then when you roll it out to frost it and decorate it, it doesn't crack.
So while we're in the cake stage, Brittany, your cake is gluten-free.
It is gluten-free, yes.
So what did you do with that?
Exactly what she just said, and looking at her recipe, you have flour in yours, mm-hmm. correct? Mine is just eggs. It is fatless. Eggs, cocoa powder, sugar, and salt. So it's because we don't have flour in that, we actually don't have to roll it right out of the oven. If you have flour in your recipe, you absolutely do. But because it's so egg heavy, it's kind of flexible and bouncy. So we don't have to worry about that. We can make several sheets.
It's almost like having an omelet cake.
It's exactly like having an omelet cake.
Okay, Kat, what's next? Now it's cooled down in the fridge, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, there's
what's
just
next?
So many stages.
I know. Keep going.
I think... obviously mixing the frosting, at least for my recipe, mixing the frosting and having that ready. And ideally, the same day that you would bake the cake, you would make the meringue mushrooms, because at least in my recipe, you need those to bake at a low temperature in the oven and then
dry
in the oven overnight. So you want to have that done, you know, the night before, so mm-hmm. that the next day you can frost your cake, fill it.
Okay, so you've unrolled it from the tea towel, mm-hmm. and now you've got your frosting. Do you mm-hmm. just spread the whole darn thing with frosting?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Just get it all over there.
Uh-huh.
It's going to be covered anyway.
Yeah,
and then
exactly.
you're going to roll it?
Yeah, and then you just roll it. I use the tea, I mean, you know, make a little indentation about an inch in so mm-hmm. that you can roll it tightly, and then just use the tea towel, and the weight of it will...
Okay, so now we have this big log
mm-hmm.
that's still got kind of a blonde cake on the outside, but mm-hmm. but icing on the inside. Do you use chocolate icing?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I use mocha.
Okay, now what? Brittany, what's the next step?
The next step is to get icing on that bad boy.
The whole thing, the while it's whole.
Yeah, well, what? First, I'm sorry, I skipped a step. You want to cut off, I don't know, 2 inches, 3 inches, mm-hmm. depending on how big you're.
For the knob?
For the knob. You need your knob. So you're going to cut off about 2 or 3 inches off the end at a bias.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're going to take that and plunk it on the side. So now you've got, I'm using my hands. Which
a little
is just
Y
silly
in your log,
air,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, you want a little, you know, a little off a branch coming off.
You want
off.
It to look like a log.
You want it to look like a log and mm-hmm. just one, you know, big straight.
Not a clean log, a log that just
exactly.
got logged.
Okay. Yeah.
Not
yeah.
a Duraflame.
All right, so now
yeah.
you put that together and then is it...
Then it's icing time.
The same icing that's on the inside?
Not for our cake. We use a chocolate mousse on the inside. Oh. It's like nice and light. And then we use a good old American buttercream on uh-huh. the outside, which yeah. is butter, powdered sugar, cocoa powder, and mm-hmm. salt.
Okay, Kat, how do you get it to look like a log then? Now it's just iced, an iced tube.
I use either a wooden skewer or a fork.
And do
I'll
what?
Kind of, you know, drag the fork down along the frosting
oh, yeah.
to make it kind of a wood grain mm-hmm. pattern, I suppose.
Bark.
Exactly, yes. Mm-hmm. And then I'll use crushed up pistachios for moss.
Oh,
for
I never
moss.
Thought of doing that. I'm stealing that idea.
Yeah, perfect.
Okay, we only have 2 minutes. So now we've got our log, we got the bark on, we've got some moss, and now you said you use candy cranberries, or you use candy instead of cranberries?
Candy instead of cranberries.
What kind?
They're the little mints that you get at the Dahlia at the door. I forget what they're called. But
those
they
are
make
Holland mints.
Holland mints.
Those are.
Thank
yeah.
you. But over the holidays, they make red ones, and they're just perfect stand-in for cranberries.
Okay. And then you already talked about the rosemary. It's kind of like that's like a little pine...
Pine branch.
A pine
yeah.
branch
yeah.
there.
Sparkly.
And then the mushrooms. I noticed the mushrooms on the Dahlia Bakery Yule log were a little more organic looking than the perfect little en français
yes.
mushrooms. Is
yes.
that
we
intentional?
Like ours to look natural. Exactly.
They're more
yeah.
natural.
Yeah.
You're more like the hallucinogenic mushrooms.
You could literally exactly.
Yeah.
One bite and
magic
everybody goes
mushrooms
home.
On ours.
And Kat, any other? Do you ever go to like Hobby Lobby and get little critters to put on top of yours,
sure.
like ants or something?
I feel like I'm being baited. I mean, I would love to, but I usually just stick to the traditional mushrooms and moss.
Okay.
You know.
All right.
Keep it classic.
Yeah.
Anything else before we sign off on this? Do you always cut the end of the log so you can see the spiral
always.
When you serve it, or do you wait for the first person to cut? So, no. So you cut the log just
yes.
so it shows off.
Yes.
Yeah. And people can learn more about it on my lunch club on December 20th here at Hot Stove Society.
You're going to teach how to make one?
I'm teaching a Yule log class.
Do we all get a three-ring binder?
No, you don't get a three-ring binder, but you will get my mother's recipe and a glass of bubbles included in the cost of the class.
That sounds so fun!
Yeah.
I'll be there.
And again, the Dahlia Bakery version is gluten-free, which is the first time I've seen that.
Yeah, it's been gluten-free for the past 2 years, and our sales really spiked. It's one of those things that happens to be gluten-free. It's not like we had to do anything weird to it to make
right.
it gluten-free.
You just like that particular recipe.
Exactly.
Well, thank you, bakers, for the Baker's Corner and the Yule Log Trust that your mom has in you. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to log out now.
Oh man.
up next, Food for Thought, Tasty Trivia on 97.3 FM, Cairo Radio. What is that? Dun, 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 dun. It's time for Seattle's Tasty Trivia right here on Cairo Radio. Tom Douglas.
Jerry Roger, the chef in the hat.
And I'm Katie O. This week's trivia quiz is provided by our friends Geeks Who Drink. They run pub quizzes nationwide, including weekly trivia nights at the Brave Horse Tavern here in Seattle. Find one near you at geekswhodrink.com. Combed, which also means these trivia questions sometimes actually quite tricky.
So there's two words in there, geeks and drink. So imagine the questions.
Okay, thanks for the tip.
It's not going to be as simple as you think.
Bridget Charters, a chef here at the Hot Stove Society, has decided to stay around. As we normally do, each of you will get five questions. Whoever gets the most correct wins. Whoever gets the least amount correct loses. This is a big, fat loser. And as we like to do, we like to play for one of our listeners. Today it's going to be Cornelius, because we loved his name
so
much.
And a good question.
Ultimately, yeah, and he had a great question too. Thierry, if you lose today, what will you give away?
Cornelius.
He was the guy in Hello, Dolly, right? He was the guy.
True.
Yeah. Oh, right. Good recall.
You love that musical. It's not a big recall for you.
I know people think I'm a big brutish kind of guy, and my favorite musical is Hello, Dolly.
And he watches Hello, Dolly every night. It's not a big deal.
He watches 9 to 5.
And he weeps every night.
Yeah.
That's right.
I can totally picture that.
Thierry.
I'm going to give him a brunch for two at Luke.
At Luke. Delicious.
At Luke.
All right. Bridget?
You know, I have a class coming up in January, the cooking of Morocco, Lebanon, and Turkey.
Oh, now that's a good one.
Claudia Roden's book, Arabesque. I'm going to give two spots to that.
That's good, because he was trying to figure out how to cook some new things. So that's good. He's going to be good.
Great.
That's fantastic. Well, you know, The Lion King is coming to the Paramount Theater.
Yes, very cool.
So I'm going to give brunch. You know, typically I like to be more generous. So I'll give brunch for four.
Oh!
To the Carlyle Room.
I'd do everybody, doesn't
it? The Carlyle Room. So when you're going to see The Lion King, you can stop by the Carlyle Room for brunch.
Cornelius has seen The Lion King. That'd
so you can go to Luke with one of your friends, or you can go to Carlyle with three of your friends.
You can either have a date, or you can, have a...
Or you could win the whole pot and not have to worry about any of that.
All right. Thierry Rotoro, you are first up.
All right. Go ahead. Hit me.
What is considered A-OK under the halal system? Is it shrimp or pork?
Shrimp.
That is correct. Mix mayonnaise with chopped garlic to get a basic version of what pungent five-letter sauce with four vowels?
Bridget would like to answer that question. She's totally like, I can't believe you got that.
Easy question.
Aioli.
That is correct. Very nice. Three, a boxty is an Irish pancake made with what tubers? It's a tuber.
I would go
Ireland.
Potato.
There we go. Bridget, you just helped
me. She was rolling her eyes in disgust that we didn't know that one.
She's like, I can't even with you. I'll just give it to you. All right. Thierry, what animal do chitlins come from?
From sheep.
It's actually pigs. Pigs is where chitlins come from.
Really?
All right. And your fifth question.
Oh, I should have known that.
Chocolate cake layers are separated by whipped cream and cherries in what cake named after a German mountain range?
So it's not Black Forest, so I'm going to go a German mountain. Matterhorn is in Switzerland. I'm going to have to come up with a mountain in Germany.
Alpencake.
That would be my answer.
Swiss of you.
Actually, Alpencake will be.
Is that your answer? It's actually Black Forest. Yeah. Black Forest is what we were looking for.
Mm-hmm.
I did say it.
Yeah, but you had no confidence in it.
I said it was probably not Black
Your
Forest.
Your intuition was right. You confused yourself.
Yes,
what
I
happened.
Did.
3 out of 5, Thierry. Not so shabby. Bridget, you're up next.
Okay.
Though the shrimp themselves are seldom so lucky, what garlic and wine dish comes from the Italian word for escape?
It's a tuber, for God's sake, from Ireland.
Oh, scampi.
There we go. We got there. All right. Your second question. Name two of the three milks in Tres Leches cake, and don't just say milk twice.
So there's condensed milk.
Uh-huh.
Whole milk.
Is that your final answer? Your two milks is condensed and whole milk?
And yes.
That is incorrect. We're looking for heavy cream, condensed milk, or evaporated milk. You had one. You kind of did it. You kind of got no.
I didn't
you
get were that close question. Enough. I'm sorry.
Okay, that's all right. That's all right. Your third question. They totally had almond milk in the Middle Ages, and good Catholics used it as a substitute during what 6.5-week season?
for Lent.
That's correct. Bridget, your fourth question. What fantastic and apropos creature would you find on a can of chicken of the sea tuna?
What fantastic and apropos mm-hmm. creature on chicken of the sea?
Yeah. Think about all the chicken of the sea tuna that you have in your pantry. What's on that tin?
Sea monster.
A sea monster? You think there's a sea monster
Dragons.
On the chicken of the sea tuna
Where's
can?
Where's that the Loch Ness monster?
When was the last time you had a can of tuna?
That's incorrect. Those are all incorrect answers. We were looking for mermaid. Bridget, your final question. Latin for seeded apple, what aggressively marketed superfruit can only be eaten by painstakingly scooping out its little arils?
Pomegranate.
That is correct. All right, you tied with Terry Rotaro.
Oh,
3 out of 5.
Teddy.
Hopefully Tom's going to do 2 and then we go home.
Tom.
For that nice
Could
gift.
Be.
They're
that
rooting
nice
against you.
Yeah,
here we
shot.
Go. Here we go. Your first...
Happy holidays to you,
yeah,
too.
Exactly. Tom, your first question. What fruit shares its name with an endangered bird and a group of, I guess we can call them people?
Kiwis.
That's correct. Very nice. True or false?
Wow, Oprah... that was good, Tom. I'm very impressed.
True or false, okra is indigenous to North America?
I'll say true.
It is actually yeah. false. We took it from Africa.
Africa. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Should have known that one.
Your third question, it's a cute little cucumber in the U.S. or a catch-all for pickles in the U.K. What's the G word?
Gherkin.
Gherkin is correct. That's a fun word.
Yeah, I like that word.
There's an extra H in there.
Kind of goes, do you have an innie or an outie or a gherkin?
A gherkin. I've got a gherkin. All right. Tom, your fourth question. What is the main vegetable that makes the base of the soup called borscht? Your favorite?
Ugh.
You don't like that?
Ugh.
Oh,
he hates
borscht
that.
Is so good.
Oh, well, no. You know what? In a funny way, I don't mind borscht as much as I mind the vegetable.
Oh. Which is what?
Beets.
That's right. Beets is correct. And your final question. What popular dish consists of a baby sheep's rib cage and all the attached muscles? It's a very interesting way of writing that question.
That is true.
We'll say it is a...
baby sheep's rib cage.
It's one of your favorites.
Really?
Yeah.
Tom's
Rack-a-lamb.
There you go. Rack-a-lamb. Very nice. That means, Tom Douglas, you are for sure the winner.
Oh.
And Terry and yeah. Bridget,
we have
you
to have
tied
a...
for losing. We have no extra questions, so I think Cornelius is going to win.
Cornelius is going to win big time.
What's he win? He wins brunch for 2?
Brunch for 2 at Luke.
And 2 tickets to my arabesque class.
Ooh. Wow. Happy holidays, Cornelius.
Bravo, Cornelius.
You could bring your friend Barnaby. If you want to be part of our show, you can send us a note. Does anyone get that?
Yes. Hello, Dolly. Oh, we know.
Everyone.
If you want to be part of our show, you can send us a note on Facebook or Twitter at Seattle Kitchen. You're listening to us on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. This show is produced by Sarah Leibovitz at Large Media. Our associate producer is Allison, and our sound engineer is Sean Don't Call Me Del Torre. If you'd like to be part of our studio audience, go to hotstovesociety.com and buy tickets for only $15. It comes with a delicious breakfast sandwich. Also, remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen, you can subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher, Apple Podcast, or download the Cairo Radio app and search for Seattle Kitchen.
Thanks for listening.
Have a great weekend.